that it is not completely out of the question that in the next few years, or maybe not handful of years, maybe in the next tens of years, we might actually know what happened 10 to the minus 36 seconds after the Big Bang and be able to say what it was with some degree of confidence. And for more details, if you're interested, you should look at a paper that I just wrote with Arthur Kozowski, a review article that appeared in ANREV, Knuckle Partzai, just a couple of weeks ago. So the way we're going to get to the first 10 to the minus 36 seconds is with maps of the cosmic microwave background. Well, let me say, I should change that. The way we hope to get to the first 10 to the minus 36 seconds is with maps of the cosmic microwave background. So the top map here is a map of the temperature of the cosmic microwave background as measured by COBE, the Cosmic Background Explorer, a NASA experiment that flew from 1991 to 1994. And down here is a simulation of what MAP, the Microwave Anisotropy Probe, should see. MAP is an experiment that NASA will launch next year. And in fact, we already have a handful of experiments that have mapped a small region of the sky here. And in fact, it does look something like this, although I haven't been able to get the data to stick in my PowerPoint presentation to show you yet. So this is a map of the temperature fluctuation of the cosmic microwave background. This is a map of the surface of the sky, 4 pi steradians. If this was a map of the Earth, North America would be over here, South America would be over here, Eurasia over here, Africa and Australia, and down here is the South Pole where a lot of these experiments are done these days. Santa Barbara would be right there, I suppose. The red band across the middle is radio emission from our own galaxy. That is not the cosmic microwave background. We are not interested in that. But if we look outside of the plane of the galaxy, for the purposes of this talk, we are not interested in that. If we look outside the plane of the galaxy, then these temperature fluctuations here are honest to goodness temperature perturbations. And the color contrast is set so that the differences between the blue and the yellowish regions are roughly temperature fluctuations of one part in 10 to the fifth. Now, the size of the splotches up here appears to be roughly 7 degrees, and the reason is not because that is these spots are intrinsically 7 degrees across in size, but it's because COBE had an angular resolution of only 7 degrees. This is now the 21st century. We have better technology, and maps should be able to get 0.3 degree or even better angular resolution. The Planck surveyor should be able to get down to 0.1 degree resolution, and a number of experiments could go even further. We expect that if we get down to small, better resolution, we should see finer structure in the cosmic microwave background, and actually experiments like Boomerang have already seen finer structure that looks like this. So I'm going to say more about what this microwave background is and how this tells us about 10 to the minus 36 seconds after the Big Bang in the rest of the talk. So the outline is as follows. First, I will review cosmology. I know there are a number of experts in the audience, and please pardon the boring review. I'll try to get through quite quickly. I think this is a fairly knowledgeable audience. And cosmology is pretty simple. There's nothing that really takes more than 5 to 10 minutes to understand. I'll then talk about the open questions that we have in cosmology today. And I will tell you how current observations, including some which have been done, some measurements which have been done partially by people in this room, have pointed now towards inflation quite unequivocally. And then I'll talk about how inflation predicts the existence of a gravitational wave background, how that gravitational wave background imprints a signal on the polarization of the cosmic microwave background, and then I'll tell you how that can be used to test inflation further, and I'll discuss a few more other things as well. I should also say down here, I will also I'll give you 4 transparencies about the dark energy in the universe. It's now fashionable, whenever you give a cosmology talk, to talk about the dark energy in the universe. So I will do that as well. And there will be a purity-violating Lagrangian term for the particle physicists in the audience who like to see Lagrangians. So the first 2 things we need to know about the universe, and perhaps the only 2, the 2 fundamental things. First of all, the universe is expanding. Every galaxy is moving away from every other galaxy, and the relative velocity with which any 2 galaxies move apart is proportional to their distance. The other thing is, we know, like it or not, that the universe is filled with a gas of photons with a temperature of 3 degrees Kelvin. I'm sorry, One of my students told me that 3 degrees Kelvin is not properly. It's 3 Kelvin. They're not degrees. So, 3 Kelvin. If you look at a gas of photons with a temperature of 3K, then the mean thermal energy of the photons is roughly a millielectron volt. Now, if this gas of photons fills the universe and the universe is expanding, then at earlier times, the wavelength of each photon would have been smaller. And since the energy of a photon is inversely proportional to its wavelength, the energies of these photons would have been correspondingly larger. And since the temperature is proportional to the energy, the temperature at earlier times must have been larger. And if we define a scale factor, A of t, where little t is the time, and the scale factor can be thought of as roughly the mean spacing between galaxies, that's going to get smaller at earlier times. If we define a scale factor, A of t, and A of t not as the scale factor today, then the temperature of this cosmic microwave background, capital T, at some earlier time, little t, would have been the temperature today, 3K, times the ratio of the scale factor at this earlier time divided by the scale factor today, inverse. And cosmologists like to define this ratio to be 1 plus z, where z is called the redshift. So as we go earlier in time, the universe is smaller, and we are dealing with larger redshifts, and the temperature of this cosmic microwave background becomes larger. So if the temperature is a millielectron volt today, we can immediately infer a history of the universe. Actually, let me go forward one slide. We can immediately infer, there it is, two slides. We can immediately infer a history of the universe. So we live in a universe with a cosmic microwave background temperature of a millielectron volt, which is about 10 billion years old. And at earlier times, this is a logarithmic scale, the temperature would have been correspondingly larger. So when the universe was only about 100,000 years old, the temperature was about an electron volt. That was a redshift of 1,000. About a second after the Big Bang, the temperature was about an MeV. About 10 to the minus 9 seconds after the Big Bang, the temperature was 100 GeV, et cetera, et cetera. And about 10 to the minus 43 seconds, the temperature would have been about 10 to the 19th GeV. And at earlier times, the general relativistic framework which underlies this entire model would have broken down, and something must have occurred here that involved quantum gravity or strings, et cetera, which we don't really know. But the rest of this timeline sort of makes sense. So, let's think about, okay, it's not necessarily true, but it does make sense. We'll get to that. So let's look back at when the universe was a temperature of an electron volt. And I'm going to explain that at this time, the cosmic microwave background photons that we see last scattered. So if we go back to the very early universe when the age was less than 300,000 years, which corresponds to a redshift bigger than 1,000, then the temperature would have been greater than an electron volt. If you have a gas with a lot of photons running around with an electron volt or larger, then those photons in this cosmic microwave background can knock electrons out of atoms. So at these earlier times, you do not expect there to be any bound atoms. You expect the universe to be a plasma that consists of free electrons and protons. And since photons scatter from charged particles like electrons, the photons in this very early universe would have had a very short mean free path, and they would have been bouncing off of the electrons quite a bit. At later times, after the universe becomes 300,000 years old, redshifts less than 1,000, the temperature of this photon gas drops below an electron volt. And at this point, the photons do no longer have enough energy to knock electrons out of protons, so electrons and protons exist as bound hydrogen atoms. And since hydrogen atoms are neutral, photons do not really scatter from them. So the photons that were around in the very early universe would have propagated freely. And the transition between these two is decoupling, and this takes place at a redshift of about 1,000. And any photons that would have existed in this primordial plasma at a redshift of 1,000 would have free-streamed or moved without scattering from this time until today. So when we look at this cosmic microwave background map over here, what we're really looking at is a spherical surface in the universe that surrounds us. And we're looking at photons that last scattered when the universe was about 300,000 years old, and that's about 15 billion light years away from us today. The universe is about 15 billion years old, so this distance is about 15 billion light years. So the photons we see have traveled 15 billion light years, and when we look at a photon coming from that direction, we're looking at some point over here. When we're looking at a photon that comes from this direction, we're looking at this point over here. And when we look at all 4 pi steradians of the cosmic microwave background sky, we are looking at the spherical surface of last scatter, and we see the universe as it was 300,000 years after the Big Bang. Now, the size of a causally connected region in the universe today is 15 billion light years. If something happened over here, there's no way we could ever tell, because there just simply wouldn't have been enough time for that photon to propagate, or any signal to propagate to us. On the other hand, when these photons last scattered, the size of a causally connected region in the universe was only about 300,000 light years across, because the universe is only 300,000 years old. So 300,000 light years is much smaller than 15 billion light years. And if you take 300,000 and divide it by 15 billion and then take account of the expansion, take into account the expansion of the universe properly, you'll find that one causally connected region in the early universe at the surface of last scatter subtends an angle of only 1 degree on the surface of the sky. And this is somewhat puzzling, because if we look at this map over here, we're looking at the entire sky here, and the entire sky consists of 40,000 square degrees. That means that when we look at this map, we're looking at 40,000 causally disconnected regions of the early universe, but each of them has the same temperature to 1 part in 10 to the 5th. So this is the famous horizon, causality, horizon, or let's see, horizon, causality, isotropy, or homogeneity problem. The experts in the audience will tell you that there are subtle differences between all four of those, but in fact, they are all the same. So, that is the horizon problem. And we've now been able to trace the history of the universe back to a redshift of about 1,000 when these photons decoupled. Okay, so electrons, protons combined to form hydrogen at this time. Galaxy formation, which is the subject of great interest these few months here at the ITP, essentially occurred yesterday on this logarithmic time scale. We can go back further in time. If we go to a second after the Big Bang, when the temperature was an MeV, the same argument that we used to suggest electrons and protons combined to form hydrogen at this time here suggests that neutrons and protons would have combined to form light elements like helium and lithium, and I should also put deuterium there. So nucleosynthesis is a theory which explains how nuclei combined to form light elements roughly 1 second after the Big Bang. And the predictions of that theory predicts abundances for these elements, have been confirmed quite remarkably by observations. So we know not only what happened at a redshift of 1,000 from the cosmic microwave background observations, but we also know what happened roughly 1 second after the Big Bang from measurements of the light element abundances. If we go back a little further, we surmise that at a temperature of about 100 MeV, quarks would have combined to form neutrons and protons, and at a temperature of about 100 GeV, 10 to the minus 9 seconds after the Big Bang, electroweak symmetry would have been broken, and things like quarks and leptons would have obtained their masses. Now, particle physicists are quite confident that the quark hadron phase transition and the electroweak phase transition certainly must have occurred, but we're still trying to get the details straight, and we certainly don't have any cosmological observations that actually can tell us what happened over here. Now, if we go back further in time, particle theorists have speculated that there is a wealth of new physics at even higher energies. And actually, I've got a little transparency there. So we've got four fundamental forces that we know about. There might be a fifth one. I don't know. I'm not suggesting that there is. Electromagnetism and the weak interactions have been unified into one electroweak theory, which is quite successful. And then there's a theory for the strong interactions that looks quite remarkably like those for the electroweak interactions. They're both gauge theories. One is SU3 gauge group, another one is SU2 and U1 gauge groups. And that similarity leads us to speculate that these three forces are actually unified at some high energy scale, 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 GeV. And these are referred to grand unified theories, or GUTs. And then there are those who are even bolder and suggest that gravity is unified with the other three forces at the Planck scale, about 10 to the 19th GeV, and these are quantum gravity and or string theories. So if we have any faith in this picture over here, then we should have faith that in the early universe, grand unification, this gut symmetry should have been broken down to the lower energy electroweak and strong interactions at a temperature about 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16 GeV. And quantum gravity would have been broken down to the other three forces at 10 to the minus 43 seconds after the Big Bang, temperature of about 10 to the 19th GeV. There are also particle theorists who surmise the existence of another symmetry, Petri-Quinn symmetry, which is used to explain the strong CP problem. If you know what Petri-Quinn symmetry breaking is, that's good. If you don't, then you don't need to know what it is. But that is some new, that's some other speculative physics that would have taken place at a temperature of about 10 to the 12 GeV. And many particle physicists also believe in the existence of supersymmetry, and supersymmetry might have been broken anywhere around here. So, if the early universe, if all these phenomena took place in the early universe, it's natural to inquire whether there are any observational relics of the extraordinary things that happened in the very early universe. And what I will explain to you is that inflation may have had something to do with some of this physics. We really don't know which, if any, of this physics it had anything to do with, but we now have very good reasons to believe that inflation did occur, and I will then explain to you that if inflation did occur, there are ways to further test inflation and check which of these new physics phenomena was responsible for inflation. So, one question that cosmologists have had for a long time is, why is the universe so flat? Okay. Actually, that's a mistake. This word should be smooth. Why is the universe so smooth? And that is the horizon or homogeneity problem that I mentioned before. The only answer we have to this, why is it that 40,000 causally disconnected regions of the early universe look so much the same? The only answer we have to that question to date is a theory, or actually not a theory, an idea called inflation. And I'm not going to explain exactly how inflation solves the horizon problem, but essentially, if we go back in the very early universe, the extraordinarily early universe, and we take out one tiny region of the universe, and we pick it to be sufficiently tiny that this region is causally connected, what inflation does is it takes this tiny causally connected region and it blows it up into a huge volume. So inflation actually says that the entire observable universe is some small segment here of something which at early times was a very tiny region within a causally connected pre-inflationary patch. So that is more or less how inflation works, and inflation explains why the universe is so smooth. Another question which we had until very recently is, what is the geometry of the universe? So we know that the universe looks very much the same everywhere you look. It's very homogeneous. It looks the same in every direction. It's quite isotropic. And if you look at the possibilities for the geometry of such a universe, it can either be flat. In other words, the laws of geometry in such a universe would satisfy those set down by Euclid several thousand years ago. It can be closed. It can be the three-dimensional analog of the surface of a sphere. The surface of a sphere is homogeneous. Every point on it is the same as every other point. And there's a three-dimensional analog. And in such a universe, the laws of geometry do not obey those set down by Euclid. And another possibility is a three-hyperboloid, an open universe. And this is sort of a three-dimensional analog of the surface of a potato chip. And again, if you look at the surface of a potato chip or a horse's saddle, every point looks roughly the same as every other point. So the three possibilities for a homogeneous isotropic universe such as the one that we see. And with general relativity, you can show that the geometry is related to a quantity omega, which is essentially the density of the universe, divided by the square of the expansion rate. Okay, H not here is the Hubble constant. And the Hubble constant is just the constant of proportionality that relates to the velocities with which galaxies move apart to their distances. So the Hubble constant is in principle something you can measure, and people actually do that. And the density of the universe is also something which, in principle, you can measure. And so it should be straightforward to construct this quantity omega and therefore determine the geometry of the universe. However, the problem has been, for the past 70 years since people have been trying to do this, is that measurements of the density of the universe are notoriously difficult, and you really won't get even two of the best friends amongst cosmologists to agree better than a factor of two on the density of any given component of the universe. Well, we might be doing a little better than that now. And the Hubble constant is also notoriously difficult to measure. There are now reasons to believe that we're close to 10%, but still, if you want to know whether omega is equal to 1 or other than 1, it's difficult to get a value for omega by these types of these measurements that's at all reliable. Fortunately, however, we can take advantage of the geometric effects of the differences between these universes, or the geometric differences between these universes, to actually determine the geometry of the universe. So the idea is as follows. The geometry is different in an open, flat, and closed universe. Let's not worry about a open, closed, or flat universe for now, but let's think about a two-dimensional surface, since that is conceptually a little simpler, and the generalization to three dimensions is quite straightforward. If I take a circle of radius r, and I draw that circle on a flat surface, then the circumference of that circle is related to the radius by 2 pi times r. On the other hand, suppose I draw a circle on the surface of a sphere. Then the radius, which is the distance from the North Pole to this latitude circle over here, is clearly going to be different. The circumference of this circle, the distance around this latitude, is clearly less than 2 pi times the distance from the North Pole to the latitude. So the geometry is different on the surface of a two-sphere. And similarly, if you look at a potato chip, this is where my PowerPoint skills crapped out. If anybody knows how to draw a potato chip on PowerPoint, I'd love to know. Well, for a while I was bringing Pringles to these colloquia and passing them out. And then I gave this talk in China, and I thought before I go to China I got to take Pringles, and so I thought I was going to smuggle them. I thought that the Chinese wouldn't want American fast food coming into their country without quarantine, but it turns out that every single store has Pringles in it. So this is a potato chip, and clearly the distance around the edge of the potato chip is going to be greater than 2 pi times the radius. Okay. So geometry is different in these three types of universes. And so since the distance around a circle is different than 2 pi times the radius, depending on if the universe is open or closed, it stands to reason that if I have an object of some fixed size here, that object will subtend an angle that is either larger or smaller than it would be in a flat universe. So, if you go through these types of arguments and go through the math a little more precisely, what you can show is that if the universe is flat, this causal horizon subtends an angle of 1 degree. However, if the universe is open, then circles are smaller. Sorry, if the universe is closed, then circles are smaller, and objects should appear to be larger than they would in a flat universe. So if omega is greater than 1, then this causal horizon subtends an angle larger than 1 degree. If the universe is open, then objects appear to be smaller than they would in a flat universe, and omega is less than 1, and you get an angle that's less than it would be in in a flat universe. So if I have something of fixed size, if I have a meter stick that I can stick at the surface of last scatter, and I can measure the angle that meter stick subtends, then I can determine the geometry of the universe. Now, unfortunately, nobody had constructed meter sticks 300,000 years after the Big Bang, but there are some things that we can use. There are essentially not one meter stick, but there's a family of meter sticks that we can use. So suppose there was an elephant standing in the field at some distance, and somebody said, "How far away is that elephant?" Well, if all elephants were precisely the same size, I could see how big that elephant appeared to be, and I could tell you exactly how far away the elephant was. Now, unfortunately, not all elephants have the same sizes, but suppose I study elephant populations, and I know what the mean size of an elephant is, and suppose there are 100 elephants standing in a field at some distance. If I measure the distribution of apparent sizes, and I know what the distribution of physical sizes are for the elephants, then I can tell you exactly how far away the elephants are. So we don't have meter sticks at the surface of last scatter, but we do have a distribution of density perturbations. Actually, let me go back a few transparencies. Remember that we see temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. If we look at this region over here, it might be bluer than a region over here. So suppose that this spot over here is bluer than this one. That means that the photons from over here are cooler than the ones from over here. Now, what we believe, and have very good reason to believe, is that those temperature fluctuations arise from density perturbations at the surface of last scatter. We see things like galaxies and clusters of galaxies and structures on even larger scales in the universe today, and the simplest and most plausible explanation is that these density perturbations, these inhomogeneities in the universe, grew via gravitational infall from tiny density perturbations in the early universe. Okay? If the early universe was perfectly smooth, then it would continue to be perfectly smooth forever. However, suppose this region of the universe was slightly less dense than this region over here. In that case, the matter from this region would accrete, would fall gravitationally onto the matter over here, and in this way, this region will become increasingly underdense, and this region will become increasingly overdense. So if I have tiny primordial density perturbations, they can grow into the large-scale structures that we see today. So if I look at the large-scale structures today, and I run Newton's laws backwards, what I find is an amplitude for the density perturbations of about 1 part in 10 to the 4 at the surface of last scatter. So suppose this region here is denser than this region over here. If that's the case, then the gravitational potential well over here will be deeper than the gravitational potential well over here, and a photon that climbs out of this region over here will therefore have to climb out of a deeper gravitational potential well. It will suffer a greater redshift and therefore appear to be redder than the photon that comes up from over here. So when we look at these temperature fluctuations, we believe that we're looking at density perturbations at the surface of last scatter. Now, the sizes of these density perturbations are not all the same, but we know something about the distribution of sizes of objects in the universe today. We know about how big clusters are, how big galaxies are, and how big structures are on even larger scales. And if we take that distribution of sizes, we can project that back in time and essentially figure out the distribution of sizes of temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. Should those hot and cold spots be 1 degree, half a degree, etc.? So this distribution of sizes of hot and cold spots has essentially been measured now. And this is a very recent work. This was essentially measurements done within the past few months. Well, measurements done last year and analyzed and published within the past few months. So the idea is that if we measure the temperature on the surface of the sky, if we measure the temperature at each point in the sky, then we've measured T of theta. Now, let's not worry about the entire sky. Let's consider just a small region of the sky so we can approximate it as flat. If I have this temperature as a function of position, I can construct Fourier coefficients T sub L. If I then square these Fourier coefficients T sub L, I can then construct this power spectrum here, and that's really what this is over here. What this plots the square of the Fourier coefficients of a temperature map as a function of wave number L. And L increases from roughly 0 to 500 on this particular plot. And as L increases, we're looking at perturbations which have smaller and smaller sizes. So L of 200 corresponds roughly to 1 degree, and L of 500 corresponds roughly to 1/5 of a degree. COBE, which had an angular resolution of 7 degrees, can only measure the very lowest multiple moments, L's of about 10. So it really only gets points out over here. Anyway, you can make predictions for what this spectrum of temperature fluctuations should look like, and that is indicated by this purple curve, this green curve, and this red curve over here. So the purple curve is the prediction for what this power spectrum, this cosmic microwave background power spectrum, should look like if the universe is flat for omega equals 1. Now, the bumps and wiggles here are due to causal physics at the surface of last scatter. You don't really need to understand the causal physics at the surface of last scatter, but it makes sense that the bumps and wiggles are due to causal physics at the surface of last scatter. And remember that the causal horizon depends an angle of 1 degree on the surface of the sky if the universe is flat. So this first bump here occurs at roughly 1 degree if the universe is flat. But if the universe is open, if omega is less than 1, then all that structure And the causal horizon is shifted to smaller angular scales, and all this structure, this bumps, these bumps over here, will get shifted to smaller angular scales or equivalently larger values of L. So if the universe were open, then the curves would look like this. However, these data points, let's see, these yellow bands come from an experiment called TOCOMAT, which is a Princeton-led collaboration. And then I think the purple points here come from Boomerang, which is a UCSB-led collaboration, isn't it? Well, UCSB, Caltech collaboration. And these points appear just within the next few months, appear on AstroPH within the next few months. And they're not going to locate the position of this first peak very precisely, but the people who've analyzed this data very carefully say that the verdict is in, the universe is flat. These points here are far more consistent with a peak being over here than a peak being over here, which is what you would expect if omega was 0.3. So there's actually another figure here. Hey, other figure's missing. Oh, okay, there's not another figure here. But I'll tell you the conclusions. Dolson and Knox analyzed a variety of experiments, the ones I showed you in the previous transparency, and they say the peak is at L of 200. They say the verdict is in, the universe is flat. And there's a more recent paper by Lloyd Knox and Lyman Page, which locates this peak from the various experiments, and there's very good overlap and agreement between the various experiments that first peak is located in L of 200 and that the universe is flat. So those are the things that we know about the universe today. But as Tom Spinchin says, the trouble with many of us is that we think we know everything, or to put it more usefully, we are often unaware of the scope and structure of our ignorance. So as a corollary to writing or talking about what we know, maybe we should add getting familiar with our ignorance. So let us now get familiar with our ignorance. So, why is the universe so flat? Hey, what happened there? Going forward. Sorry. So there are other things that we don't know. So why is the universe so flat? Presumably because of inflation. I should say, actually, that did belong there. All right. So the new question. Okay, until a few months ago, we said, what is the geometry of the universe? That was the big prize in cosmology. Now we know that the universe is flat, or at least have very good reasons to believe that the universe is flat. Now the question is, why is the universe so flat? And the answer, again, is inflation. You can show that if inflation, via the mechanism which has now been erased, produces a very smooth universe, then it must also produce a universe which is flat. In other words, inflation can only work if the universe today is flat. So, we have an answer to that question, but what don't we have an answer to? Or what other questions would we like to know the answers to? Cosmologists are interested in knowing where do large-scale structure, things like galaxies, clusters, and even larger-scale clustering come from. And back in the 80s, this was a rich field for theorists because there weren't very many constraining observations. And the models that people had were explosions, cosmic strings, global monopoles, soft phase transitions, loitering universes, which Albert Stebbins said was an idea put forward by loitering cosmologists. There were soft phase transitions, textures, superconducting cosmic strings was Ed Witten's entry into the game. These were cosmic strings which had the additional advantage that they blew up. And Jerry Ostreicher liked that a lot. Rolling scalar fields, late time phase transitions, et cetera, et cetera. However, after COBE, and now with the measurement of the first peak in particular, the only model that we really have, the only tree still standing in this forest, is gravitational infall from a nearly scale invariant spectrum of primordial perturbations. So I think most theorists had thrown in the towel on just about everything else after COBE, but there were still a few others that stuck around. However, I should say, without going into detail, that the existence of this peak structure in the cosmic microwave background is predicted by primordial adiabatic perturbations. So the fact that we've seen this first peak over here already suggests quite strongly that we're on the right track with primordial adiabatic perturbations. And there are higher peaks over here, second and third peaks, that should be mapped by Boomerang, or actually presumably may have been mapped by Boomerang, but they haven't released the results yet. And if you see these higher peaks over here, then that would essentially put a nail in the coffins of all of these alternative models for structure formation. So I think that the verdict is in with structure formation. I think we now know that large-scale structure grew by gravitational infall from a nearly scale-invariant spectrum of primordial adiabatic perturbations. And the interesting thing about this is that inflation predicts a nearly scale-invariant spectrum of gravitational primordial adiabatic perturbations. So this is something we now know with some confidence that we did not really know with as much confidence just even a few months ago. So if we believe that, then what's the next step? We have the geometry of the universe, and this appears to be flat. We have structure formation, which seems to grow from primordial adiabatic perturbations. And the universe, we know, is smooth. Inflation predicts all three of these things, so all three of these independent observations seem to suggest that we're on the right track with inflation. So if we believe that we're on the right track with inflation, the next question we should ask, let's go back a few over here. We now have good reason to believe that inflation occurred, so maybe we should take these question marks out, or maybe these question marks should now imply, what is the new physics responsible for inflation? Was it something that happened at relatively low energy scales that may have had something to do with supersymmetry breaking, or even, God forbid, electroweak symmetry breaking? Or did it have something to do with quantum gravity or grain unification or Petrie-Quinn symmetry breaking? So those are reasonable questions. And the way you could distinguish between these various models is by trying to identify the energy scale of inflation, 10 to the 12th, 10 to the 19th, 100, 10 to the 16th, etc. So the question we would like to ask now is, what is the energy scale of inflation? And the way that we can do this is with a stochastic, by looking for a stochastic gravitational wave background. So inflation predicts a smooth universe, a flat universe, and adiabatic perturbations. It makes a fourth prediction quite robustly, and that fourth robust prediction is the existence of a stochastic gravitational wave background. And it also predicts quite robustly that the amplitude of this gravitational wave background is proportional to the square of the energy scale of inflation. So if we can measure, if we can detect this gravitational wave background, we can measure its amplitude. In principle, we can determine the square of the energy scale of inflation, and thus the energy scale of inflation by taking simply the square root of the square. So how do we detect a gravitational wave? Well, let's think about an electromagnetic wave first. So suppose we want to detect an electromagnetic wave. What we do is we take a dipole, a positive charge and a negative charge, and as that electromagnetic wave passes, that dipole will oscillate. The positions between the charges will change in time. Now, a gravitational wave is a propagating disturbance in the gravitational field, just like an electromagnetic wave is a propagating disturbance in the electromagnetic field. So the way you detect a gravitational wave is by looking for motions not of test charges, but of test masses. And since you cannot have dipole gravitational radiation, you can have only quadrupolar gravitational radiation, what you look for is, in other words, if I had a mass here, and a mass here, as a gravitational field passed, they would both move in the same way, so there would be no change in the distance. But if I have a gravitational wave passing through a ring of test masses, then what happens is, as the gravitational wave passes that ring of test masses, that ring gets elongated in this direction, then it becomes spherical, then it gets elongated in this direction, then it becomes spherical, etc., etc. So to detect the gravitational wave, you look for quadrupolar oscillations of a ring of test masses. And actually, at this point, this is my most advanced PowerPoint figure. There'll be nothing else that comes up to par after this. So, inflation predicts a stochastic gravitational wave background, and it predicts gravitational waves of all wavelengths. Okay, broad spectrum of gravitational waves. And it also predicts the existence of gravitational waves which have wavelengths comparable to the horizon today. So suppose we want to detect a gravitational wave with a wavelength comparable to the horizon of the universe. How would we do that? Well, the way we would do that is what we would use for our ring of test masses is the surface of last scatter. Remember that when we look at the cosmic microwave background, well, here it is. Remember that when we look at the cosmic microwave background, we're looking at a surface of last scatter at the edge of the observable volume of the universe. And the photons that we see scatter from the plasma in the early universe. So what we're going to use for our ring of test masses is actually, well, we're not going to use a ring of test masses. We'll use a sphere of test masses. And the sphere of test masses will be the surface of last scatter. So suppose a gravitational wave, a single gravitational wave is propagating in the z direction, which is up in this figure here. As it moves, it will induce motions in the surface of last scatter, in the plasma at the surface of last scatter, and it will induce quadrupolar oscillations. So if we look at this particular latitude around the direction of propagation, you'll see a quadrupolar pattern of temperature perturbation. So here's a hot spot, cold spot, and that's a quadrupolar symmetry there. And you see the same thing over here. You see hot spot, cold spot, hot spot, cold spot. And as you go in this direction, what you see are crests and troughs of the gravitational wave, or in other words, or in another sense, the twisting of the gravitational wave as it propagates. So this is precisely what the temperature pattern would look like if there was a single gravitational wave propagating in the z direction. Now, unfortunately, inflation does not predict the existence of one gravitational wave. It predicts the existence of a stochastic gravitational wave background. So this is more similar to what you would expect to see from the gravitational waves predicted by inflation. Now, I should say this is a simulation that was generated by a student at Columbia named Levin Wadley. Now, gravitational waves will induce temperature perturbations or temperature fluctuations such as those shown here, but those are not the only things that produce temperature fluctuations. Density perturbations in the early universe will produce temperature fluctuations, as I explained earlier. So this is a simulation of what a temperature map could look like for a plausible spectrum of density perturbations. And if you look quite closely at the two and try to determine the differences, you will not succeed because Levin was very clever, and he chose the spectrum of density perturbations just so that they would mimic those of gravitational waves or vice versa. So the bottom line of this exercise is that you cannot really detect gravitational waves by looking at the temperature perturbations alone. That sounds bad. The good news, however, is that you can determine, tell the difference between density perturbations and gravitational waves by looking at the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. So in addition to producing temperature fluctuations, density perturbations and gravitational waves will both induce polarization in the cosmic microwave background. And there are little hairs superimposed on this temperature map. So the color contrasts are the temperature, and then these little hairs, which might be kind of difficult to see, and those represent the linear polarization state of the cosmic microwave background at each position on the surface of the sky. So the point of this is to show, or to illustrate, that although the temperature patterns can be the same, the polarization patterns will be different. It's kind of hard to see by eye, but if you look, for example, at these little hairs up here, they're different than the little hairs over here. These stick out a bit more than those. And what I claim is that by looking at these little hairs, by measuring these little hairs in the cosmic microwave background, you can distinguish gravitational waves from density perturbations. So nobody's going to claim that you can do this just by looking at them. However, there is a way, given a map that looks like this, or like this, of determining whether it comes from gravitational waves or density perturbations, or what fractional contributions you get from density perturbations and gravitational waves. So the idea involves some fairly elementary mathematics. If you have a temperature map, then you've measured the temperature T in every direction, hat n, on the surface of the sky. So you've measured a function on a two-dimensional surface. If you measure the polarization of the cosmic microwave background as a function of position on the sky, the polarization, the linear polarization state, can be represented by a vector. Now, I know that there are sophisticated people in this audience who know that the polarization is not really represented properly by a vector. It's more properly a symmetric trace-free 2x2 tensor or a spin 2 field. I know that. But everything I tell you about vectors can be translated and done more properly, and has been done more properly, for symmetric trace-free 2x2 tensors and or spin 2 fields. So back to the vector. So suppose the polarization has been measured every point in the sky. Then we have this polarization vector as a function of position on the sky. And the surface of the sky is a two-dimensional surface. If I have a vector field on a two-dimensional surface, I can write that as the gradient of some scalar field A plus the curl of some other vector field, B. Naturally, in two dimensions, this B is not a vector field, it's a scalar. Okay. And I can decompose, if I'm given this polarization map, I can figure out which part came from the gradient and which part came from the curl by taking the divergence or the curl of the left-hand side. If I take the divergence of the left-hand side, then this term here disappears, and I'm left with only the gradient component. If I take the curl of the left-hand side, then the gradient component disappears, and I'm left with only the curl component. So if I'm given a polarization map, I can decompose it into its curl and curl-free parts. Now the physics here is that density perturbations are scalar, produce scalar perturbations to the space-time metric. The only thing you can say about a density perturbation is that this region of the universe is denser than this one. So density perturbations have no handedness, they're scalar perturbations, so they cannot produce a polarization with a curl. On the other hand, gravitational waves are propagating disturbances in the space-time metric or in the gravitational field. Gravitational waves, just like photons or electromagnetic waves, can be right and left circularly polarized. The same is true of gravitational waves. Gravitational waves can have a handedness, and so they can, and in fact, when you look at it carefully, they do produce a curl in the cosmic microwave background. So if you measure this CMB polarization, and then you find that it has a non-zero curl, so if you measure this polarization, you take the curl, and you find that it's non-zero, then you've detected gravitational waves in a model-independent fashion. So, just to illustrate a bit more, the top part are examples of curl-free polarization patterns. I mean, these have some curvature, but these are neither right nor left-handed. These two patterns here are right or left-handed. So there's a left-handed part, and this is a right-handed part. And essentially, what I claim is that if you look at the density perturbation polarization spectrum here, this polarization pattern here is constructed essentially by throwing down cookie cutter patterns of all sizes that look like this, whereas if I look at this polarization signal down here, I claim that that is constructed by throwing cookie cutter patterns of all sizes down that look something like this. And I also claim that by taking the divergence and curl, you can tell which part came from this and which part came from this. So, the question you should ask now, is this at all detectable? So, recall that the gravitational wave amplitude is proportional to the energy scale, to the square of the energy scale of inflation. So if the energy scale of inflation is extremely small, then the gravitational wave amplitude will be very small. If it's big, then this will be big. Now, we've already seen that gravitational waves would produce temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background. We already know that from Kobe that delta T over T, the amplitude of temperature fluctuations, is about 10 to the minus 5. Some of that is due to density perturbations, and some is due to gravitational waves, most generally. So what we can tell is that the contribution from gravitational waves is at most 10 to the minus 5. And from this, we can already infer that the energy scale of inflation has to be less than 2 times 10 to the 16th GeV. So we have good reasons to believe that inflation occurred. And we already know from Kobe that if inflation did occur, the energy scale had to be less than 2 times 10 to the 16th GeV. So the next question is, can we detect this polarization pattern? So the gravitational waves produce this polarization pattern. We want to know if it's detectable. Well, the answer is, if the energy scale of inflation is much less than 10 to the 15th GeV. So for example, if somebody surmises that inflation has something to do with electroweak symmetry breaking, or even with Petrie-Quinn symmetry breaking, then this gravitational wave background exists, but its amplitude is way too small for the polarization to ever be detected. But if the energy scale of inflation is something closer to 10 to the 15th to 10 to the 16th GeV, in other words, if inflation had something to do with grain unification, and at least back in the early days, most theorists did surmise that this is what inflation had something to do with, if inflation had something to do with guts, and there are good reasons to believe so, then the polarization, turns out, is conceivably detectable by Planck, or if not by Planck, then by a realistic post-Planck experiment. So if you believe that inflation occurred and that it had something to do with grain unification, then this polarization signal is conceivably detectable within an academic lifetime.
Can I ask a question? Do you think that this delta amplitude, proportional to the inflation square, that this
proportionality factor of the, what's the proportionality factor?
That coefficient must depend on very detail.
Oh no, it does not depend on. Let me explain more precisely what I mean. Inflation postulates the existence of some scalar field, which we call the inflaton, as you know, which has a potential that looks like this, or maybe, you know, if you live in Northern California, it looks like that. But this is inflaton potential, and this is phi. And during inflation, phi is hung up in this false vacuum over here. And this height here is V. And when I say E sub infl there, what I mean precisely is this. Yeah. So what I'm really doing is measuring the height of the inflaton potential. So I think I have another transparency that I should tell you. So with Planck, you will get somewhere into the interesting region of parameter space. So let me show you something that Will Kinney made. So Will Kinney made this plot in 1998. What it plots is essentially the tensor amplitude, which he calls R, versus N, the scalar spectral index, which is another parameter that pops out of inflation models, which we won't really worry about. But you see that there are several orders of magnitude here, and he looked at a variety of classes of inflationary models. So he looked at exponential inflation, power law inflation, linear inflation, spontaneous symmetry breaking, and what they call natural inflation. So these are five classes of models, and just about any inflation model you find in the literature can fall into one of these five classes. And you see that each of these models makes a prediction for the tensor amplitude. The upper limit here is essentially what Kobe has accessed. So essentially anything above here has already been ruled out by Kobe. Planck should be able to get down to a sensitivity of roughly that. So any of these three models, if those are the correct models for inflation, should produce a polarization signal that's detectable with Planck. And Planck is already scheduled to fly by the European Space Agency in 6 or 7 years. Now, I should say that that's not going to be the end of the line. And in fact, there are people thinking about what to do after that, or maybe even concurrently with Planck. And as just one example, I mentioned some people that I know at Caltech, Andrew Lang, Jonas Moudinis, Jamie Bach, and there's actually a grad student named Bill Jones who's also working on this. They have a new concept for polarized CMB detectors, which they call CAMOA, which stands for Compact Array Millimeter, for Millimeter Wave Astronomy. And it's based on, the idea is based somewhat on infrared detectors that have operated at slightly higher frequencies that have already worked. And they say that you can get an order of magnitude improvement on the sensitivity of Planck, essentially with the same size focal plane, and the advantage is that you don't need the feed horns that you need for Planck. So essentially, for every square inch of detector, they can get a factor of 10 sensitivity that's better. And moreover, they can do that with about 1/10 the weight load. So it's conceivable that you get a much larger focal plane for the same price as Planck, or even for less. Now, they have not built these yet, so it's not fact yet, but there are ideas for going well beyond Planck that are already being germinated. The other thing is, so let's see, so with CAMOA, you could get down an order of magnitude further and probe quite a bit of this parameter space. The other thing is Planck is going to survey the entire sky because it is primarily a mission to map the temperature of the cosmic microwave background, but Andrew Jaffe, Liming Wong, and I recently looked at this, and we found that if you actually concentrate on a smaller region of sky rather than the entire sky, you can improve your sensitivity to this gravitational wave signal by a factor of 30. So already, with fairly realistic concepts, we can get, in principle, to a sensitivity better of about 300 times that of Planck to this gravitational wave signal with an experiment that one could envision, say, on a 10-year timescale. Okay, so this is not so several order of magnitude improvements over what we've seen with Planck, which itself is a several order of magnitude improvement over COBE, are conceivable and can be envisioned in the not too distant future. So essentially, with these experiments, the grand unified models cut off somewhere around here, So with such types of experiments, you could really essentially test whether inflation had something to do with grain unification or not. You could not, a null result could not rule out inflation most generally, because inflation may have taken place at much lower energy scales. But on the other hand, if inflation had something to do with grain unification, there's a good chance that these experiments would actually see something. What other theory of structure formation do you have in mind? Well, that's always a possibility. There's always the unknown, and as Thomas Pynchon has reminded us, we should survey the structure and scope of our ignorance. But the inflationary scenario is hanging together quite well, and it's going to be further tested with Knapp and Planck. And if you see these gravitational waves, then it would all hang together. Oh, I see what you're saying. So you could always speculate. Suppose I measure gravitational wave amplitude down here. Then you could come along and say, okay, that's lovely. That's good. Let's applaud the experimentalists who carried out this daunting task. But you would then say, suppose there were some topological defect background. Suppose there are cosmic strings running around, and they have nothing to do with inflation, but they do have something to do with, well, they produce gravitational waves. Well, you're right. That could produce a gravitational wave background, but you can look at the power spectra of the gravitational waves, and the power spectra, I guess, is what you wanted me to say, right? Okay. So, as Simon, what Simon is trying to say is that this is really just a first effort, and if you actually detect this gravitational wave background, you can measure the power spectrum of the polarization. And people have done these calculations, and the power spectra for topological defects differ from the power spectra for inflation. So you can actually determine, in principle, the difference, whether these gravitational waves actually come from inflation or not, i.e. there are further tests yet of this picture. Okay, so since there are particle physicists in the audience, this is a brief aside. We have this scenario for unification. And in this scenario, electromagnetism and electroweak interactions are a low energy limit, one of the low energy limits of some grain unified and or Planck scale physics model. Now, electroweak interactions are parity violating, so it stands to reason that whatever Planck scale physics and or grain unification that gave rise to electroweak theory at low energies should have also been parity violating, or at least allow for the possibility of parity breaking. So one can speculate or wonder or inquire whether parity is violated in any of the other fundamental interactions, like gravity or strong interactions, or maybe in some yet undiscovered fifth force. Well, presumably some new physics arises to produce the gravitational waves from inflation, and thus this polarization signature, this polarization signal. And you can ask whether the polarization signal can give you a signature of parity violation. And the answer is yes. Remember that we can measure if we measure a polarization map, then we can decompose it into a curl component and a gradient component. Turns out that the curl component and the gradient component have different parity transformation properties. The gradient component is even under a parity transformation. The curl component is odd under a parity transformation. So if you measure these two components and you find that there's some cross-correlation, then that is a signature of parity breaking. So as an exercise, Arthur Liu, Lehman Wong, both postdocs at Columbia, and I last year looked to see if we could construct a model that would actually give rise to this parity-violating signature. And we found two examples. One is a scalar field that's coupled to the F mu nu tilde of electromagnetism, the pseudoscalar of electromagnetism. And this is something that Sean Carroll had considered. And this is also the term that would give rise to this cosmological birefringence, which has now been shown to probably not be right. But if you had such a term and the scalar field rolled at late times, then in addition to rotating the polarization of radio sources, it would also rotate the polarization of the cosmic microwave background. and that would give rise to this parity violating source. Here, the parity violation, it's actually a PT violating operator, and it's actually T that's violated because phi is rolling. There's a given T direction from the rolling of phi, and that translates then into a P violation through this term over here. You can also then construct a gravitational analog, phi coupling to epsilon, mu, nu, rho, sigma, and then some R's with various indices, where these R's are the Riemann curvature tensor. So you can add a term like this to the Lagrangian for for gravitation, and you can show that this will really have no effect on just about anything else in general relativity. But if this term existed, then during inflation, one could produce, you would have parity violation during inflation, and one could produce more right-handed gravitational waves than left-handed gravitational waves. And then you can show that if you do have a preponderance of right versus left-handed gravitational waves, then you actually do get this a cross-correlation between the gradient and curl components. So we've actually worked that out, and you find that you can get that. So I'm not claiming that this is going to actually happen, but it's interesting that you can actually talk about looking for these things with the cosmic microwave background. Okay, so what else? Inflation predicts a distribution of primordial density perturbations that is Gaussian, so delta T over T should be Gaussian. A lot of people have worked on this, including Mark Srednicki. Liming Wong and I have recently wrote a paper where we essentially point out that there have been numerous models of inflation that predict non-Gaussian primordial perturbations, but all of those work only with isocurvature perturbations. Since isocurvature perturbations now seem to be inconsistent, we have to deal with inflation models that predict adiabatic perturbations, and those are actually the simpler ones, and those models cannot predict any non-Gaussianity that will ever be detectable. You can also look for non-Gaussianity not only in the cosmic microwave background, but also with large-scale structure surveys, and Verde, Wong, Heavens, and I recently showed that the CMB will provide more precise tests of primordial Gaussianity in most models than galaxy surveys. Conversely, those of you who are interested in non-Gaussianity and large-scale structure can say that if we measure a CMB map with Planck, for example, that is perfectly consistent with Gaussian, then we can be confident that we can then use Gaussian initial conditions with complete confidence and ascribe any non-Gaussianity in large-scale structure surveys to the effects of biasing. That's for the experts in the audience who like to talk about biasing. Okay, so I'll skip that and leave it for a question. So to conclude, it seems that we're on the right track with inflation. I was saying that a few years ago, a lot of people were saying that a few years ago, but now we have even more reason to believe that we're on the right track with inflation. I was talking to Paul Steinhardt a little while ago. He said back in 1981, 82, when people were first working inflation models out, they were also working out cosmic strings and superconducting cosmic strings and topological defect models and all these things. And nobody had any real reason to believe that any one of these ideas was right, let alone any of them. But now we really do have good reason to believe that inflation is right. It's not really speculation anymore. It's being tested empirically. And the good news is that we can look forward to even more empirical tests. In particular, if we can measure the CMB polarization signal from this gravitational wave background, we can, in principle, get a smoking gun signature of inflation. And if we detect this thing, we not only get a smoking gun signature of inflation, we can also identify the new physics responsible for inflation. Thanks.